So we're going to start our panel now. And my name is Sam Lefko. I am a principal of the planning and design firm Eric, and I also happen to serve on the RPA board of directors. And it's a pleasure to be facilitating this conversation today about what's going on in the transportation sector and both the promise and the concerns that come with technology, mobility, and new forms of transportation that we're experiencing in our lives today. And it's entitled sort of the transportation revolution, but just when you look at what's going on in the world and all the changes that are taking place, it's sort of part of a much larger set of changes that are happening. If we just stop to reflect a moment on what we're experiencing, we've seen a revitalization and a real urban renaissance, and we have all returned to the city. With that, we've seen sort of a 60% increase in cycling, and at the same time, we've also seen a 60% increase in our over 65 population. We've seen things like the sharing economy emerge as a $100 billion set of services and activities that are taking place. And many of those companies within the sharing economy are really about connecting people to services and people to activities rather than making things and producing products, which is interesting in and of itself. You know, the lifestyle changes that we see that go along with that mean that we have a teenage population today that is 40% lower in terms of driver's license uptake. And all of that means that we have very different needs and different desires when it comes to transportation and moving about our cities and our communities. In the past few years, we've seen that technology companies have really entered the transportation sector, and they are redefining what we expect from our transportation providers. And they're really redefining what we expect as users of those transportation systems. I don't know that anyone expected when the iPhone was introduced 10 years ago this year that it might be the device through which we connect with all these different services. But it's really helped us work with different companies in terms of connecting ourselves to the things that we need in our daily lives. Transportation network companies have tapped into a way to market and went from relative obscurity in 2010 to being a very meaningful part of our transportation system today. And it's really a worldwide phenomenon. They're offering us all greater convenience, greater choice. They're clearly meeting some needs that their customers want, and their customers are clearly highly satisfied with the services they provide. But I think their proliferation in New York and around the world are raising a series of questions. You know, is the proliferation of TNCs a good match with urban places? And does the urban transportation policy that's been focused on sustainable and active mobility in the past two decades really need to evolve? Is there a convergence of interests here that might result in a really productive partnership between industry and government to better meet the needs of our urban residents and the transportation needs that they look for? And when we think a little bit further into the future, how might technology change in terms of the modal options that we're looking for and the modal options we need? And what happens when technology goes from connecting us to the services that we're looking for to actually operating the systems that we'll be riding, whether it's a connected automated vehicle or a transit system? Our panel is steeped in these questions, and our panel is probably uniquely qualified to speak to these questions and to share with us their experiences, both working in the marketplace, studying the marketplace, and trying to understand where it's going in the future. Bruce Schaller, who's joining us on the panel, is very focused on what's happening in New York City today. And he has really helped us through his analysis and his work gain a better understanding of what is the TNC activity in New York City doing, what does it mean for the city, what are the public policy implications of their presence and their success in New York City, and what is their success in New York and around the country, if not the world, mean for urban policy and urban residents. Bruce is currently principal of Schaller Consulting. He's based in Brooklyn, New York. And before that, he was deputy commissioner for traffic and planning at the New York City Department of Transportation. He held managerial responsibilities at New York City's Taxi and Limousine Commission, as well as MTA and New York City Transit. He's also the author of several recent reports on app-based ride services, such as Uber and Lyft, and their impact on taxi and transit ridership and traffic congestion. And Bruce is really going to start our conversation today about what's going on in the market, what is it that people want, and what is going on relative to TNCs and the urban transportation system. The leaders in this revolution and really changing the face of transportation today comes from Uber. Uber is really the largest provider of on-demand transportation services in the market throughout the country and around the world. Whether someone needs to get home after a long day, get out to the airport, or connect with an important social service, Uber is really changing what we want and what we need in those gaps in the marketplace. Matt Wing, who sits to my right, is the corporate communications lead for Uber, and he's really focused on the future of transportation and urban mobility. But prior to joining Uber, he served as Governor Cuomo's press secretary in his first term as communications director in his re-election campaign. As we continue on our panel's resume, Ford is a company that is very familiar with revolutionizing the transportation sector. It was a company that really made automobiles available to the middle class for the first time and also pioneered the concept of a living wage. Like the founding of the company today, Ford Smart Mobility is really part of thinking about how technology and mobility changes will shape the transportation market of the future. And Jessica Robinson, who's sitting next to Bruce, is the director for City Solutions at Ford Smart Mobility, where she's working with cities to understand local priorities and to identify new mobility solutions to meet current and future transportation needs. She previously worked at a startup accelerated program, TechStars, and partners include Virgin Media, Cox Enterprises, Anheuser-Busch, InBev, to further global ecosystems focusing on empowering entrepreneurs. Last on the panel is someone who's certainly well-known to probably many in the room, and who has long been in discussions about changing our transportation for the better and being very user-focused. Robin Chase is a revolutionary herself. She is the co-founder and former CEO of Zipcar, so thank you very much, Robin. I appreciate that program. And she has been, Zipcar is the largest car sharing company in the world, and she's also a co-founder and member of Vinia, a vehicle communications company that's building networking fabric for the internet of moving things. Her recent book is Peers, Inc., How People, Platforms, and Investing Inventing the Collaborative Economy and Reinventing Capitalism, and her current passion is working with cities to maximize the transformation possible with the introduction of self-driving cars. So each of our panelists will speak to a slightly different topic. We'll sort of start with the diagnosis of what's going on today. And so what are we seeing? What is it that people want? How are companies responding to that? And then how is the industry thinking about providing transportation services now, and how are they positioning for the future? And then we'll close with, where do we think all of this is taking us? Are we really set up for success? Are we really ready for the connected automated vehicle that we're told is in the horizon? And then after that, we'll open it up to a few questions from our panelists and then some questions from you. And so with that, I'd like to invite Bruce up to the stand to give us a few words on what's going on right now in New York City.
Thank you, Trent, and good afternoon, everybody. I'm going to very quickly go through highlights from my recent research on the growth of Uber, Lyft, and other app-based ride services and the implications for how to make this transportation revolution good for cities as a whole and the way they function, as well as good for individual travelers as they move around town. So there are currently five transportation network companies, as they're called, in New York City. Uber is by far the largest, although the market share of the others is actually growing more quickly. And their ridership, 131 million passengers last year, and recently surpassed the number of yellow cab passengers in New York City. They've doubled in size every 6 to 12 months over the past several years, as customers have embraced them as quick, reliable, comfortable, and affordable ways to get around town. The time and location of this growth reveals gaps and deficiencies in the existing transportation networks that show what customers want and give a good clue as to where we're going overall in the transportation system. So let me go through some of those findings about where this growth is occurring. There's sort of two maps that you should have in mind for this, two mental maps. The first shows where the TNC trips are, and you can see they're concentrated in the Manhattan core, although there's also a substantial number of them in the area immediately around the core and then the outer neighborhoods of the city. That's the first map. The second map shows The second map shows where TNCs have grown when you combine the growth of TNCs and then take into account the decline in yellow cab trips. So this is how they've grown the pie, and the overall taxi TNC numbers are shown here. And in that case, because the yellow cabs have gone down by 20-something percent in Manhattan, most of the growth in the combined taxi and TNC trip pie is in the outer parts of the city. Indicative of the lack of street hail activity or accessibility and access to readily available prearranged car services, as well as the often slow and circuitous transit options that people have in those neighborhoods. Within Manhattan, TNCs predominate over taxi cabs around the periphery. This is how many TNC trips per 100 taxi trips around the periphery of the island, indicative of a lack of yellow cab availability in those neighborhoods. If you look by time of day, again within Manhattan, the growth in this overall taxi TNC trip making, during daytime hours, you see there's not much growth at all, in fact, although there's been a shift of about 25% of yellow cab trips over to TNCs, indicating, I think in those hours, that shift is due to the perceived comfort and ease of payment offered by the TNCs. You have substantial growth in the peak hours, particularly the PM peak, and in the evening, indicating a combination of a shortage of yellow cabs in the PM peak as they change shifts, and then the attraction of comfort on longer trips, and certainly issues of reliability, crowd, and crowding on the subway. So you see in these growth and change numbers and how things are shifting and growing, you see underlying are the universal factors that govern mode choice: travel time, reliability, comfort, and price. And so when you think about what this shows, what New Yorkers want, it's very simple. People want to save time and reduce stress. TNCs deliver on this, making them a great, and I would say overdue, additional option that's very beneficial to people moving around the city. That said, their growth also raises issues related to congestion emissions and transit impacts. The growth of TNCs has added 600 million miles of travel citywide over the last 3 years. And as a percentage of overall vehicle miles traveled, is about 7% in the inner part of the city, a very substantial number. The heaviest growth is from 4 to 7 p.m. in Midtown Manhattan, the most congested time and place in the city. That's on the streets. Underground, there are impacts as well, I think. Here you see subway ridership, which leveled off in 2015 and declined slightly in 2016, even as the economy, indicated by the orange line, continued to grow. Subway riders, fed up with crowding and delays, now have an option to go back upstairs and use their smartphone app and get a TNC. And I estimate that over the last 2 years, about a third of the gap in those two lines is people moving from the subway to TNCs. The overall effect is a historic shift in how the city is growing. Instead of the subway and the bus accounting for the vast majority of growth in travel in New York City, which was the case until 2015, TNCs now lead the way in the growth of non-personal auto travel. This is a trend that over time is not sustainable on city streets. So what's happening here, and the fundamental challenge, is that satisfying customer needs, which the TNCs have done very well, has resulted in a shift to smaller vehicles. So while the subway and the bus carry 18 or so and 31 or so passengers at a time, passenger miles over vehicle miles, and the private auto carries about 1.5 in New York City, taxis and TNCs both are averaging approximately 1 passenger mile per vehicle mile of travel. Even with lots of pooling, real sharing of rides, and even with very efficient operations and little deadhead between a pickup, between a drop-off of one trip and the pickup of another trip, TNCs as sedans, as long as they're sedan and SUV vehicles, are only going to average 2 or 3 passengers at a time. I think this is certainly a problem, but it's also an opportunity. TNCs have done us a favor, in a way, by starkly exposing the gaps and deficiencies in the existing transportation system and calling the question about whether we invest smartly in the myriad of ways necessary, not high-visibility legacy projects, but the 1,000 pieces of the puzzle focused on operations and infrastructure of our roadway and transit networks that are required to get back to that, save time, and reduce stress. In my report, I talk in some detail about the different policies, that can help transit compete effectively with TNCs. I'm not going to go into that in detail. As we move toward, and those are very vital to be doing now, as we move toward autonomous vehicles and a vision of shared electric autonomous vehicles, the task is to design some type of a network of shared autonomous vehicles that can achieve these types of efficiencies, and probably some premium service that aren't as efficient, while at the same time providing speed, reliability, and comfort that the TNCs are offering. Here we need to figure out the balance between efficiencies from pooling and having people walk to a pickup point while maintaining short wait times, close to door-to-door service, demand-responsive, reliable, and transparent operations. So I think if there's going to be a revolution that's good for cities that comes out of these developments, it's going to be about finding this market with availability, quality, price, choice, and efficiency.
Thanks, Bruce. So I'll just spend a little bit of time sort of laying out from the perspective of one TNC Uber how we've impacted the city, both from a marketplace perspective geographically and then also from a product perspective. I'll go a little bit faster because Bruce covered a lot of this, but this is a prettier version of the first maps you did, just a little nicer. And this looks at our growth over time since we launched here. We launched in New York about 5.5 years ago. And what you see really bears out what Bruce spoke to at the beginning of his PowerPoint, which is high core usage in Manhattan, but then also this rapid expansion as we get up to 2016 all the way out. And you can even see a little bit of the lights there in Staten Island of available rides and trips being used. Today, 40% of our trips in New York City are just in the outer boroughs, meaning they never touch Manhattan. And I think a large part of the reason for that utilization and for this growth is, and the part of, I think, what explains why our growth has been so rapid in New York in the most recent years is there was this really strong demand within the market and need for affordable, reliable ride outside of Manhattan, and it just wasn't available. I grew up in New York City in Brooklyn, and I, my entire life, could not get a cab in Brooklyn. I could barely get a cab to take me to Brooklyn, except by getting in and locking the door, and I think Uber, Lyft, and the other folks in this space, just by virtue of efficiency, were able to sort of tackle that issue. Then when you think about not just where we're delivering service, but also how, and Bruce touched on this a little bit, Uber Pool today, which is one of our most popular products, which matches two trips where, you know, I'm going somewhere, another person is going to a similar location, we're both leaving from relatively the same place, our algorithm matches those two trips, I get in at the beginning, they end up getting in the middle, I get out first, they get out second. This is a chart of a graph of San Francisco, which is where we've had pooled the longest. Today, 50% of people choose to in San Francisco who use Uber use pool. On the left, you see what trips would look like if everyone who was using pool at this given time were instead choosing just to do an individual ride on, say, UberX. And as you can see, the traffic volume is much more intense than on the... And this, by the way, probably sort of reflective of where we were before we had pool, although on a much lesser trip volume. On the right, you see what it actually is, which is much more reduced traffic. In New York City, we've had pool for not quite as long today. 25% of trips on Uber in New York are pooled, and it's growing. And it's frankly the place where we spend the most amount of time and obsess the most over how to get that right, because frankly, it's a problem that people have been trying to tackle for years. Since the 60s, we've had HOV lanes, and they've just never fundamentally changed behavior. In 2009, then-Mayor Bloomberg proposed a cab-sharing program in the city, and it didn't actually pan out. I mean, when I first came into Uber and we introduced pool, I was very skeptical because I thought New Yorkers are never going to share a car together. It's one thing to get in the subway, but it's one thing to get in a car with a stranger. And I have been pleasantly surprised by how much it's taken off. Then zooming out outside of the city and looking more at the suburbs, we see a very different impact and very different trends. So this is our trips by time in a variety of cities all across the world. And I just put it up to illustrate a point, which is our peak really is between 12 and 1 a.m. And that's a time that traditionally it's really hard to get a cab or some sort of alternate form of transit. In a lot of cities, either transit is not available or it's shutting down. It's also a time when you probably shouldn't be behind the wheel, because if you're out at midnight or 1 in the morning, chances are you've had a few drinks. In the suburbs in particular, we see this to be the most attractive time that people want to use our service, because frankly, it's when they need it the most, and it's the most effective for them. We recently did a pilot in Evesham, New Jersey, at the beginning of 2016, where the city, and it's basically a village, where the city offered free rides home from their downtown at the exact time that bars closed. And over the first 3 months of that pilot, they saw a 55% reduction in DUIs as a result. That's just one case study, but I think we see that impact a lot, especially in the more suburban areas, as a good usage. And then the other program I wanted to talk about is in Summit, New Jersey, which is a similar sort of suburb-type town. They were confronting this problem where everyone was driving in to connect with NJ Transit, and leaving their car in parking lots, and there just weren't enough parking lots to facilitate it. They had 5 active lots. They were about to build a 6th. It was going to take public land, and it was going to cost them a significant amount of money. Their city manager approached us about doing a program where essentially instead of residents paying for parking, they just paid for an Uber to the train station and from the train station. That pilot started in the fall of last year. It just got re-upped. And this is sort of a peek at when we see, and this is a much lower number of trips because it's a small town, but you see, again, sort of like the dynamic of our trips overall in Summit, New Jersey, and it's predominantly in the morning hour at 7 a.m., and then again in the evening when people are coming home. The relationship that Bruce was speaking to between us and transit, I do think is both interesting and complex, but one of the things that we think we offer the most advantage is connecting people to sort of the last mile of their trip. Because if you look at New York City's subway system, it was designed primarily to bring people into Manhattan to work and then bring them home in a fixed line transit. And the problem is that's just not the way New York City is today, which is why 40% of our trips in New York don't even touch Manhattan. People want a better option, and where before they might have been driving themselves in, we think them connecting to transit via Uber, via Uber Pool in a convenient way, is the best way to go. We also see, conversely, when transit expands, there are reductions. The Rudin Center put out a report on the Second Avenue subway expansion, which showed that taxi trips in the area had decreased. We saw the same trend, I'm sure. I can't speak for Lyft or Via or any of the other companies, but I'm sure they did too, because when, as Bruce said, what do New Yorkers want, right? They want speed and they want less stress. And if you have a really quick, easy walk to the subway and then you can go fast, that's what I believe you're going to choose to do. And then lastly, and I think we'll talk about this more on the panel, this is a really new project that we just started. One of the dynamics that we face, particularly in New York, is this conflict between the data the company is willing to share, because it's from Silicon Valley, because within the tech community there's a great premium placed on privacy, and what the city wants. We share more data about how we operate in New York than pretty much anywhere else. To try to fix that in other areas, we launched Uber Movement, which in February of this year, which allows cities, urban planners, and really anybody to go on and look at our data in micro areas, basically in different zones within the neighborhood, looking at speed, looking at congestion, time of day, out, like in a given hour on a Sunday, to see patterns. We currently have that live in 4 cities around the world: Manila, Sydney, D.C., and Boston, and we're hoping to expand it in the near future. And that's it for me.
And I don't have any slides, so maybe if we could just take this screen dark for a second. So my name is Jessica Robinson. I'm the Director of City Solutions for Ford Smart Mobility. And we are a new business unit that Ford Motor Company set up last year to focus specifically on new ways that Ford might improve people's lives by changing the way we move around in urban centers. And what we're out to do is build truly useful mobility solutions in an urban context. And the reason we set up this group is we recognize that the only way that we were going to be able to build services like this was to get out and have conversations with folks like you here in the room today. Because there are very unique situations in your cities that we want to work with you to address, but there are also universal or more higher order things as well, so congestion, air quality. And so it's the nexus of the two that Ford Smart Mobility is really out to address. And again, so our City Solutions team, our goal is really to connect the needs in the conversations that we might have together with services that Ford builds. And you may have seen Ford talk a little bit about this vision of the city of tomorrow. And I'll start there as the future and work back to where we are today. So I'll have you think with me of the city of tomorrow is 30 years from now, when technology, autonomous vehicles, and new urban plans actually proliferate. And that's a time and a place, certainly in America, where, you know, we might have new progress towards reduction in emissions goals. We may finally be able to achieve Vision Zero, which I know is so important for so many people in the room. And we may actually have near universal access to transportation to address some of the equity problems that we have in our cities. But that's the future. That doesn't mean we're focused specifically there. We're also thinking about in this near term, both today, but in the next 5 to 10 years. And this is an amazing time to be having these conversations about mobility and transportation. We'll see the arrival of self-driving cars. We'll see cars connected both to one another, but to our infrastructure in new ways. And we'll increasingly see the electrification of these vehicles. So we have all of these technologies at the forefront, but again, it comes back to working together to make sure that the implementation and the impact on our cities is what we all want for ourselves. And so before I get to autonomous vehicles, which I know folks are probably curious about, I wanted to share a little bit more about what Ford is doing on the modal side of services. Bruce mentioned TNCs, so often we think about Lyft and Uber, and some of the others mentioned in New York. Ford actually operates a TNC. It's called Chariot. It's a startup that we acquired last year and currently operates in San Francisco and Austin. But what I want you to think about is that TNCs can be different than what we have on the streets today. So Chariot is focused specifically on solving the commute issue, which we know is one of those times when our cities are clogged. And it uses a 14-passenger vehicle. So you're seeing efficiency in the type, the number of vehicles that are on the road. And Ford actually commissioned a study with KPMG, and early indicators suggest that shared Chariot on the road in the U.S. could reduce 10 personal vehicles or single vehicles during commute hour. So it actually has a potential to benefit the congestion that we all face. And what's important here, too, is that Chariot operates on a crowdsourced route. So we listened, again, to the community where there is an unmet need. And a great example of where Chariot is actually complementing existing services in Austin, Texas, where they run, we saw the peak for bar hours. There's the folks that have to get home after we all get home and go to bed from a night out. In Austin, there's a late night service worker route. So you could take transit into downtown to start your shift and actually have a guaranteed safe ride home on a shared service. But there's other things. Again, probably surprisingly, Ford Motor Company, you might not think that we're looking at other modes beyond vehicles. We actually partner with bike sharing as well. We're the lead sponsor of the bike sharing network in San Francisco, which will grow the impact there in the region 10x when that expands this year. And so what I hope sticks with you is when you see Ford, don't just think that we're looking at modes. We're also thinking about modes from vehicles we might manufacture. We're very interested to understand how the vehicles we might produce fit into the urban fabric that's already here and complement high-frequency transit. But I mentioned I would talk about autonomous vehicles. We can get into this on the panel as well. So Ford is committed to a level 4 self-driving vehicle in 2021. So it's just around the corner. And for those of you who are not automotive engineers, myself included, level 4 means that this vehicle will operate in a geofence environment in a city. It will have no steering wheel, no brake pedal, and no gas pedal. And it will be for Ford, when that vehicle is launched in production, it will be in a ride-sharing, ride-hailing, or package delivery type of a situation. So you will not be able to go out in 2021 and purchase an autonomous vehicle from Ford. We see these vehicles being deployed in urban centers, and we're very committed to understanding the high frequency, high utilization of these vehicles. And again, to be quite frank, they're very expensive. So it's in everyone's best interest to make sure these vehicles are highly utilized when they come out on the road. But again, what's important for Ford is we know that when these vehicles arrive in your cities, our cities, there are going to be changes that need to be made. And we can, again, talk a little bit more about that. But it's things like road permissions, how do they interact with pedestrians or other vulnerable roadway users. And we are engaged with mayors and other elected officials through a number of organizations, including Bloomberg Philanthropies, who's convened a conversation with global mayors about the impact of autonomous vehicles in our cities. So I will leave it for there. If you want to talk more, I look forward to your questions.
So we're a planning organization here, this group, and I wanted to just start with the imperative. Before this imperative is climate, and I wanted to lead with a quote from a good friend of mine, Christiana Figueres, who led the UNFCCC to the Paris Agreement. The infrastructure we build over the next 3 years will determine the fate of humanity. To repeat that for you guys, building infrastructure and planning for the next 25 years, the infrastructure we build over the next 3 years will determine the fate of humanity. So I am deep into what happens in the transportation sector in cities. I'm going to be talking about autonomous vehicles and not. So around autonomous vehicles, cities are in a one-time position of power. This is it. The people who are building those cars are supplicants, and they need to. We're creating the position in which they get to come into our cities. So I want mayors and states to recognize that this is the time for them to dictate how do we want technology to happen to us and to be overt. So these slides are really going to be around that. I'm right now working on creating a coalition of mayors around the world that are adopting some of these principles. And I think that's the only way. When a city goes one by one, they're negotiating with these huge multinational and global companies, and there's only so much leverage you have, which is an inadequate amount. So if we can get cities to band together on common principles, I think we can get some interesting work done. I think it's politically possible. I've been struck by the fact that mayors and states around the world are interested in talking about autonomous vehicle policy because it's kind of sexy and it shows that they're innovative on the front edge. There's going to be a very big financial imperative for politicians that if we have electric AVs, it completely transforms the infrastructure financing revenue that they're getting. So already, we know it's already inadequate. And if we have these electric AVs, we're not going to have fuel taxes, we're not going to be getting parking fees, we're going to have reduced registration fees, and if we manage to make them shared, there'll be reduced tolls and hopefully no fines. So there's going to be this incredible plummet. I was talking to someone in the state of Massachusetts. He thinks between 60 and 80% of our revenues will decline, and if this transition happens fast, it'll be within like a five-year period. So we need to start paying attention to that, and I think politicians should be focused on this. And right now, if ever there's going to be a moment when there's fewer stakeholders, it is now. Now is the time when there aren't a lot of stakeholders around autonomous vehicles, and we need to tee up the behaviors and use cases that we want before behaviors and use cases that we don't want happen in our cities. So when the companies who are building these cars want to be sending darts in my direction because they don't want me talking about these things like taxes, I want to say this is the same, self-driving or not, these vehicles are metal boxes on our scarce streets. This is the reality, and these are the issues that we want to address. So I think many of these issues are ones that we should be addressing today because we've had 125 years of cars and we've done it wrong. We've done some things right and many things wrong, and we're living with that wrongness. So I don't see it as something special for AVs. We should be doing this with all vehicles, and so here we go. So the first one is, if we think about transportation, it really is something it's a network, and therefore it really tends towards monopolies. If we don't act now, we're going to see in the self-driving arena just what we see in telcos, which means we'll have a choice of three nationwide, and in your city you'll have a choice of one. That it really, these transportation networks really take advantage of the network effects appropriately. So I believe that we need to crack open those network effects and benefits and provide these public data commons. So we need some standard open APIs that are applied around shared use vehicles. And I'm working on that, as are others, and I think that's about to happen. So we need this to ensure competition so your local guy can still compete against the big guys, so we can use roads efficiently, and so that new startups that we haven't even thought of today can actually get into the system and we can evolve and improve. Okay, the second thing is we definitely profoundly need to tie EVs to AVs, and that is not at all the case. When you talk to the manufacturers, which I have, AVs for them are they're agnostic. It could be internal combustion, it could be AVs. In dense and urban areas where we have big populations, for sure, things should be electric. And not only those, I want to say, let's start today. So starting in 2020, all new vehicles intended for shared or intensive use must be clean and EVs. And by 2025, all of our shared and intensive use fleets should be zero emission. And while I say that, this is great. We've got 3 years for you to plan to know your new vehicles are this way, and you've got 8 years to swap out your fleet. I don't think it's a big ask. It actually has nothing to do with climate change. It has to do with air quality in cities. We should be doing this. Around user fees, and I think this is coming back to this, is that states need to start transitioning to user fees based on fuel type. I'm sorry, I don't know how to move. So based on fuel type and footprint, distance traveled, curb rights, and congestion. These are things that have been problems for our cities. Biden just talked about, and earlier in the panel before, that there are all these things that we don't want to, that we're too scared to address. We have to address these issues. They're fundamental problems with cars we have today, and are going to be increasingly so with self-driving cars. There's so many things I want to say, but I don't have time. So efficient use of public roads. This is a lot of what Bruce was calling out. It's not great when right now the subways are moving 4 to 6 people per square meter during peak times, yet we've let the luxury of people in their own cars or in a Lyft or an Uber or a taxi be able to occupy 10.5 square meters. It is a travesty that during peak times we let them get away with that, and we continue to let them get away with that. And when we move to these self-driving cars and the idea of promoting efficiency, we have to price per square meter on the roads because during peak times, because that will mean, why will I take the subway or why will I take a 12-person van or a 2-person van? It is completely dictated on this congestion price per square meter. We have to start going there. I think there's other ways to get at congestion, and we should be dealing with those too. Connectivity. The future of connected cars and autonomous vehicles profoundly requires ubiquitous, reliable connectivity. And while you guys build out your infrastructure for wireless traffic lights and wireless telephone poles, you continue to neglect... I'm sorry, I don't know how to make that stop. You continue to neglect to put in and make possible the standards for vehicles, the wireless standards for vehicles, which is dedicated short-range communications, and it's a different radio. So whenever you're putting in a street light or a traffic light that has wireless, you should be putting in the possibility to have what is going to pull in vehicles into this wireless grid. So we have to open things up. And lastly, and around autonomous vehicles. So all those other things have policy has nothing to do with autonomous vehicles. We should do them. We should do them anyway. And if we do them all right, once we get to autonomous vehicles, we only have to have one rule. And the one rule would be all autonomous vehicles operating in densely populated areas must be part of a shared fleet, because we would have corrected for all those other things. Do I stop? Or do I say why?
Go for it.
Okay. Okay, so here's why. Okay. Number one, we want to maximize the learning per vehicle in these first years. These are brand new vehicles on the streets, and if you own your own, you're only using 4% of the time. If they're in shared fleets, each one of these vehicles will be providing a huge amount of learning. They'll be used 60% of the time. That's really important. Number two, around safety and maintenance. If you want Robin Chase to make sure she's kept her LiDAR clean and is downloaded the latest software, I'm not going to do it. I travel all the time. I never pay attention. We need to have these things in fleets where there's a professional whose life's job it is to make sure these things are well maintained and up to date. Number three, from a perspective of access, it can't only be wealthy people who are buying Fords and Teslas. Like, that's really unfair. We need people. If we make them shared, it means a person can buy a seat in a shared autonomous vehicle and enjoy the benefits of shared autonomous vehicles. It's a good thing for these companies because we can help aggregate demand, pool demand, and so they have fewer people they're trying to sell to. And just as Jessica said, all the people who are talking about doing this right now are selling vehicles right now, are saying, yeah, our first one's going to be in shared fleets. Well, then let's codify that. Let's say in our cities and densely populated, they need to be shared fleets. And one more sentence, why this is so incredibly important is because if you ask the man on the street and yourselves, but perhaps before you came in here, when you thought of autonomous vehicles, you thought, oh, that car is just going to become autonomous. And that is an incredible travesty. We don't just want the cars and the congestion and the huge time waste and 20% of the average household's income going to cars. This gives us the opportunity to have shared fleets in cities, and this gives us the breathing space to make that a reality. I think people will do it because we have companies like Lyft and Ford that are working on it. Can I say one more sentence? I'm trying for time here. So when you think about autonomous vehicles, the key points to take away are three. One, we have to get this right because of climate change. Number two, the marginal cost of moving an electric autonomous vehicle is $2 an hour. So if you think I'm paying for a parking meter, you are wrong. I'm not going to be paying for a parking garage or parking meter or anything at all like that. And what it does for retail is also terrifying. I might not want to be paying for retail rents. I'm just going to have my car driving around. So the economics is transformed. And lastly, the tools that we as planners have been used to address cars has been parking and congestion, so constraining parking and addressing congestion. What Uber and Lyft and taxis are showing today is that parking constraints are irrelevant because these vehicles don't park. And when we're going to autonomous, every vehicle will not be constrained by parking, which means our other tool of congestion is one we have to press down on now. Thanks.
Well, thank you all for those very interesting talks. Really appreciate it. I think we can probably agree, but I don't know if we don't, but I'll test that out, that we think that TNCs and the arrival of transportation services have made urban living easier and people's lives better. It seems to me that when Uber and Lyft and other companies emerged into the marketplace, it was a bit of a surprise to many of us. And a lot of cities were caught off guard and are still trying to figure out how to make sense of the proliferation of these kinds of services in our urban streets. And at the same time, I think we all recognize that technology is moving faster and faster, and it's making these services easier to use, more efficient, et cetera. And we all probably recognize that soon we will have cars that can drive themselves and have connected automated vehicles. What do we think the right framework is for that kind of technology revolution in the transportation marketplace successful? What needs to happen so that industry and government can work together and so that these systems can really add value, make our lives better, and yet protect against what's potentially going to erode the quality of life in cities if we have too much congestion and the systems don't work together, or if they work against some of the policies the cities have fought hard for over the last 20 years to really shift us to walking, shift us to biking, really make transit successful. I'm wondering if each one of our panelists would like to comment on that statement.
Whoever wants to go first.
I think it's an interesting, my bigger concern is I think most governments probably don't know. I think part of what Robin was speaking to and part of what Bruce analyzed, or at least, tried to amplify on, there's been so much change in just this part of the marketplace so fast. And change is scary, and change comes often with unintended consequences. So how do you design the right framework for what would be the best way for autonomous vehicles to interact? The emphasis on electric and environmental concerns are very incredibly important for the future of the planet in general. I think there's also a dynamic of there's a missed, at least I've experienced this having spent most of my time in government and then going to the private sector. There's a real gap between a lot of these companies, I think and understand. They're just technologically way ahead of where a lot of their counterparts in government agencies are. It's not, and that's frankly a function of salary, opportunity, and how we all care about the less glamorous parts of public service. And I think bridging that gap, if I had to choose one priority for finding the right answers within government, that's what I think really needs to happen. I really would love if there were more collaboration between some of the folks in my company, and certainly at several moments we offered this, and our counterparts in government to better understand what we're both doing, why we do it, and how it works, because you can't treat this growing industry with the same tools that you treated taxis or subways, because I think they missed this market, which then resulted in this explosive change, which then leads us to these next, well, how do we deal with the consequences?
So I actually completely agree with that. And I think it's been very good how the TNCs have filled the gaps and showed where they are and that it can be done. You don't have to argue about whether. I spent years with the taxi industry arguing about what they could do. They said, we can't do it. I said, you need some competition. Little did any of us know. So I think this is fast evolving. It's fast changing. It's unpredictable. It's not something you can plan out or plan for, particularly with the chariots and the sort of the micro transit companies. My sense is that it's very much a process of finding the market right now. And the only way to find the market is to try a bunch of things and then see what works. That's not something the government would be good at doing or planning. So I think the process to answer the question should be to have a big discussion about what outcomes we want. That's a public-private discussion. Agree, at least for the moment, on what those outcomes should look like. Have a big discussion about how we track whether we're getting there, so that's a data discussion. And then have lots of room for experimentation and feedback and adjustment. And this is what the TNCs and Uber in particular try all sorts of different things. And some of them, most of them don't work. But there's a fast feedback. There's fast fail. And that's what private sector is good at and government's really bad at. So you want to keep that on the private side. And I think over time then, if we sort of got down and worked together in that fashion, it's good to hear Matt say what he did. One of the things I found about Uber is as I talk to people at Uber, close your ears, they all say, like, we want to work with you more and we'd like to get you more data, but somehow that doesn't trickle all the way. Trickle isn't the word, but it doesn't work its way up. And you don't actually get the data unless, like with the city, you mandate it. So I think that's the process that we need to have. And I think that there are examples of having that type of a process, so I can envision it. Having a successful planning process that gets us to where we want to go. I've been trying to think of a good example in a situation like this. And The only thing I can think of is 1916 and the automobile. And the only way, and what you saw, I have a graph I'm using in a different presentation, is fatalities going up, 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 up before anything was done. You have to have a tangible problem like that before you can solve it. And that's not the path we want to go down, as Robin has been talking about. So I would say define outcomes, have a method of tracking that, evaluating that, and then have a process of experimenting and finding the market.
That's a little closer. So, I mean, again, with the theme of sitting at the table, I mean, we would agree as well. But I guess what I would add to the conversation is, as we think about a fast-moving environment, it's one thing to try and accept that, and another to closer. Okay, it's another thing to deal with it. I apologize. On the point of data, I think what would be interesting to consider is many cities have kind of done their 2020-2025 vision. And so what I would ask is, rather than technology for technology's sake, to say we've got smart roadways, and connected intersections, think about technology that will enable you to gather additional data to better inform, to Bruce's point, whether you're making progress toward the goals that you've outlined for your region. And that's not any one particular mode. It certainly, I think, crosses the board. But then with that in hand at the table, with industry or with even your transit agency, you are then able to say, we want to make an impact in this area. Here's what our data locally is showing us. And then we can work together on that. So I think, you know, that would be what I would suggest in this conversation.
Think of the goals that Bruce said. Is it working? I see cities could have a goal of providing safe, accessible, competitive, and evolvable any city and efficient use of cities and roads. I feel like there's kind of those words are the ones that pull it together. And having a wait-and-see approach won't give us those things. So I feel like if we stick to, I do like the idea of measuring, of providing things to measurement around data, but I feel like there are these basic tenets that aren't going to hinder experimentation and evolution and will still give us these safe, accessible, efficacious streets. And I guess I outlined those.
So it seems to me in a time of great change and evolution and a really dynamic moment, there's a lot of opportunity to do things well. There's a lot of excitement around what's possible. And it also seems like there are a lot of risks in those times. And since this is sort of new to all of us, both in terms of the TNC impact in the marketplace and the role of technology, not just in service provision, but in terms of vehicle operations in the near future, what do you think the greatest risks we're facing right now in terms of the marketplace, how it might change, and how it might affect cities if we're not actively working together and planning for that new future?
The greatest risks. I would agree with Robin's construct from the opening of her talk, the risk that we somehow stumble into a world where every car that exists in its current model is just autonomous and being used exactly the same way. I think if that were, and it doesn't feel like that's where, even regardless of where governments do go or don't go, it doesn't feel like that's where it's going, although it's very, very early. I think that would be terrible because there's a real opportunity when you're going to fundamentally transition how we travel in cars. There's opportunities to, instead of having incremental things like fuel taxes or incentives for green cars, there's to just overhaul the whole thing and say, let's make the whole thing electric, for example. Like that's, you can just do that overnight from the outset, and that's super exciting and better than trying to work back from that problem after you've not really addressed it, which is where I think we are now with our traditional modes of car transportation. I also think the other thing perhaps would be a little bit different risk would be the risk of emotional reaction, mainstream reaction, driving, focusing on the wrong problems. And I say that to say the most coverage that I've seen from a negative perspective on autonomous vehicles has been about crash incidents, right? Which totally makes sense. The first, the Tesla incident, Uber had its own incidents with that. And I've always, I'm terrified of driving in cars. Like, I hate driving. If I could, I would not have a driver's license. And it's because it's one of the top causes of... What?
I'll rip it up for you.
Yeah. Thank you. And it's because it's one of the... I get scared on the road, and one of the top causes of death in America is on the road, is car accidents. And I think these vehicles are just different. I had an opportunity to go in one in Pittsburgh, and the car at one point, at one street, was like a centimeter, maybe half an inch from the curb as it was going, which if you were a normal human driver, you would never do, and was scary to me, right? But the reason why is because the car had mapped that street, and it knew that trucks drove the other way and took up more of the lane. So it was safer for the computer to program it to be half an inch from the curb, because the computer knows where the curb is from its map, and it's never going to, like, have a human jerk reaction where it goes over. And I think if we see accidents, like an individual accident, say, oh, we should kill this technology, we should forget it, we should just throw it away, it's just too dangerous, I think that would be a shame, and that would be a psychological reaction from the mass public that would result in poor policy.
So there's one risk in terms of the proliferation of vehicles that we've been talking about. The other risk is institutional. The risk that our cities, city and state governments, and our transit agencies aren't up to the task, aren't nimble enough by far in being able to deal with this effectively. And I was reading something that came out of the University of California that talked about how all the sort of nimble things the transit agencies need to do to adapt to the changing environment. And all I can say is it ain't going to happen. Like, I know these institutions. And the flip side of it is that if they try to do it, then they may take their eye off the ball of daily operations, and there's examples of this, and you run into a lot of safety and service problems then. There's a reason that transit agencies focus on their operations. I've worked in them. I've worked for the New York City DOT in an operational capacity. There's a reason you get up every day and you worry about safety and operations, because you need to make it work. So we need to look very – so one risk is that we don't adapt institutionally and have the right structures to be able to do the kinds of things we're talking about. That's on the public side. I think on the private side, and this speaks to the risk that Matthew was just talking about, is there's a risk and I think this is probably the biggest risk of all, is that these companies, which frankly don't have a good, you know, record of following the rules all the time and engaging in a constructive way all the time – continue that course, and then they will end up with getting the reaction when one bad thing happens, because they haven't been working together with the public and with government to bring everyone along as to how this works, what to expect, how to react when something bad happens, because things will happen in the course of this. And when you form the relationships and educated people and been responsive to their concerns, people will accept a lot of bumps in the road. When you've said, no, we know better, we're just going to do it, your rules are all wrong, it doesn't fit our business model, right? Have we heard that ever, right? When that's been the attitude, then there's a bump in the road, it's going to be a big to-do, and it's going to be bad for everybody as a result. So I think that the institutional risks here are something that we need to really work hard on.
So I think I'll just comment on two types of risk. The first is safety and actually related to fear and technology. You know, we've talked a lot about autonomous vehicles and whether they're better or worse than human drivers. You know, again, we have 35,000 people a year that die as vulnerable roadway users. Computers can be safer than human drivers. But I think, you know, it's important when we think about risk, when you see autonomous vehicles in a city for us to use, they will have been put through millions more miles than any of us have ever driven in our entire lives. Ford's been working on autonomous vehicles for over 10 years now, and we're still talking about being years away before we're comfortable putting anyone in them. So I think it's important to note that when we think about risk. But I would actually have us think about risk slightly differently, which is to the impact of systems more broadly. And I think the risk that we all face is if we each continue to operate the way we have been. And implied in that is an assumption that what we're all doing individually is working. And we're in an amazing moment in time where people are moving to cities because of the benefits there, but our cities are clogged with traffic. Housing is expensive because people can't afford, because they need to be close to jobs, but there's such a demand for that housing. And so, you know, if we go on our own way and you go on your own way and you go on your own way, someone will win. But again, if we push ourselves and challenge ourselves collectively to come to the table and say, you know what, maybe this bus line really isn't working as a fixed route bus with a 40-foot vehicle on it. Let's think about doing something more demand responsive or changing the pricing. I think that's the only way that we will move forward. So the big risk is not collaborating.
You guys covered some really good ones. I'm with you on all of those things. So I guess I'd just put a little color around my greatest fear is many of those things. So another fear would be this idea of zombie vehicles. And I think you've got it down for passengers, but I just want to paint a little picture of the retail version. Picture that Amazon, who knows the 100 most purchased objects in Manhattan or perhaps in Soho, instead of having their warehouse out in New Jersey or Connecticut or wherever it is, because it costs so little to be driving these, to have these vehicles on the road, our roads, which we've now nicely shared all of our trips, we're all down to the 10% of cars that we need, will now be filled with warehouses and inventories running around on these streets. And that will happen if we don't get the pricing right on zero occupancy vehicles. So I just want to throw that into your mind of horrible things that can happen.
Something. Before we open it up to the audience, I wanted to come back to something that you had said, Jessica. You had said that Ford anticipates a level 4 driverless vehicle on the road in 2021, which is less than 5.
Production ready.
Production ready, yeah. Okay, and then soon to follow on the roads. What do you think that means for Ford as a business? And then I'd be curious to know from Matt how he thinks the availability of that type of vehicle might change his business, and then what Bruce and Robin might think about what that means to look, the feel, and the context of our city streets when those vehicles are actually out in the public realm.
Yeah. So thanks. So when you have a company like ours investing billions of dollars in R&D, you can be sure that we think it's going to be good for business. But the path, I think, you know, is different than this idea of, again, an autonomous vehicle in everyone's driveway. I mean, we don't all have driveways now, running and fetching my dry cleaning and things like that. I mean, if we ever get to that, that is far off into the future. I mean, industry projections are very low penetration of personally purchased vehicles that are self-driving for decades. So for us, the question is, with the development of these really expensive vehicles with really expensive software, can we build a business around it and participate in, you know, the operating of that business? And we see that as a piece of the future of our company. But I think it's important that you understand it's not the only piece of a future of our company. You know, when we set up a separate LLC specifically to go after shared modes, that's a recognition of all the other amazing things that are happening and other ways that we can get around. And I think beyond that, there's all kinds of software that needs to be developed to facilitate the kinds of interactions we might envision for vehicles or other modes and our citizens. And, you know, we'd like to take a crack at that, too.
With the caveat that I'm neither an AV expert nor should I ever run a business ever in my life. But I think from our perspective, it's, again, it's similar in the sense that we see AVs complementing what we already exist. I think we're sort of the opposite of where Ford is, right? We're not manufacturing these vehicles. We have a partnership with Volvo, who is. We have some on the road in Arizona, some in California, some in Pittsburgh, where we're doing primarily testing, although folks can request and end up in an autonomous Uber. Because our, and Ruth illustrated this in New York, but this is pretty true everywhere, our growth is so, has been so sustained and in many cases dramatic because of this need in the market. There's, our biggest need is getting people in cars, and I think our vision is a world somewhere down the line where the car is on what we call a continuous trip, where people are just, where every ride is shared. It's not just some. Almost every ride is pooled except for some sort of luxury service, and people are just getting in and out, and that's going to be a mix between human and AV. But we are still, that future is still a ways away, and we're obviously not the only company that's trying to get there. So I don't think we really know what that future is going to look like, especially with the competition that's undoubtedly going to exist within the sector, and certainly, you know, depending on how different governments in different countries and cities respond and how they try to grapple with that issue and address it.
So I'm glad to hear the two of you kind of tamp down some of the hype that's typically associated with this topic. So I think cities, I think the opportunity in what you just said is for cities to use the high cost of these vehicles to advantage, because the economics of it will mitigate toward larger vehicles with more paying passengers. And I'm not sure what that means in terms of the vehicle technology. I think we're still figuring out what it means operationally and what the service model is. But it sounds, I'll just say two things. One is, from the comments, it sounds like it'll be a very slow, long process. But the flip side, or sort of what argues in my mind against that, is that once you hit a price point that it makes financial sense to do the substitution, and you have a business and service model that works, I don't know, in a highly competitive environment, I don't know why it wouldn't just be like, kaboom, and it takes off.
I'm going to be optimistic now. So I think it is going to be faster and cheaper. And so I'm just going to talk about what it could look like. And you guys are making your 20-year plan, right, or 25-year plan. So this is what I'd like to see in year 20, 20 years from now, that on our city streets, we only have 15% of the cars we have today, that half of my trips, which are less than 3 miles an hour, I do by biking or walking, and I feel safe and happy and pleased. There's lots of street trees. It's a great environment. We have an incredibly thriving street and retail life because when I'm a pedestrian or when I walk, I get on and off very quickly, and so retail continues to thrive. I'll be spending $3,000 a year, or a third of what I'm spending today of my household income, those dollars that I'm not spending on a car that's going outside of my city and outside of my state and probably outside of my country today, are going to be able to be spent locally. And I think we will have the thriving, livable cities that we need for our just climate future.
That's a nice point to stop a commentary from the panel. I suspect there might be a question or two from the audience, so we'd like to open it up for questions. Hands have already gone up. There's one right here in row three. I would like to ask that you please be sure that you ask a question, which means an answer to the question mark, and something that panelists can respond to. Please keep them short if you can.
Hi. Thank you. What is the configuration, then, just to build on your last comment, the spatial and urban design implications of this new technology in terms of, are we talking about narrowing streets, getting rid of on-street parking opportunities, therefore allowing space for tree planting that's in the dense city, and in more of a suburban context, Are we getting rid of then large parking lots that are around big shopping centers and things of that nature? So can you talk a little bit about the spatial configuration question and kind of from an urban design perspective?
So I would recommend to you the OECD IT International Transport Forum has done a bunch of really good reports that will point out to where they give these 30% need of cars, 10%, and then 3% on these different configurations. I think we definitely are going to have no on-street parking. We'll have some dedicated pickup and drop-off places. We should not have any parking garages because the existing parking that is today will more than adequately be available for refueling or washing or whatever's going to happen with those cars. I do like to think that we will have, I just came back from the Netherlands, we'll have great walkable, bikeable, treed spaces. And if you are stop doing parking minimums, for sure, and if someone insists on building parking, it should be flat plate, 10-foot ceilings that can be turning to something else later.
Thank you. Next question. Over here, by the column.
In addition to detail, it seems to me if that's the price, you have a huge impact on the hotels as well. Because why wouldn't you fly into JFA, get picked up by a box,
and then have that box drive around New York doing what it does, and then at night it'll just wander up and down the West Side Highway. At that price, it's $60 a night. I mean, that seems like a, you know, terrifying opportunity.
Real estate on
wheels. Next question. I'll get you next. I think we're going to
that.
I'm afraid.
Yeah, I don't know how to do that.
Hi, I wanted to get back to the question about failing fast and learning from it and whether public agencies could get there. Do you think that there are concrete steps that the public agencies can take to make it okay to fail? Is it pulling the public or the private sector in into P3s? Is it getting the public ready for a failure? I'd really like to hear your thoughts on that.
So, Willa, as you know, there's something that USDOT called a sandbox. Forgetting the first word to it. And I think that's sort of the right concept, that there needs to be, the risk should all be private sector. I think that will be fine. And then there needs to be, what I would do is create a new entity within the city from a city standpoint that can deal with this and be very focused on it rather than take existing agencies and try and sort of convert them. And do some experimentation and establish the kinds of vision and metrics that I talked about earlier. And I think that that's a pretty straightforward approach, very doable approach to this. And then over time, and that's typically how organizations change. And I know from personal experiences, you know, you create a new entity, and then over time that gets absorbed and combined into the larger entity. But it needs to be something that can be focused on task and can have the appropriate expertise and kind of the freedom of movement and to think creatively. And so organizationally, I think there are good models for doing this. It doesn't involve taking existing agencies that are very operationally oriented and trying to teach the old dog new tricks. It involves getting a new dog. I think the new dog could do this pretty well.
I just want to add from, I think there's a lot you would need and should do to overhaul this, and I wonder if it's realistic, but first and foremost, you've got to deal with some of the civil service requirements, but you should also be incentivizing public service far more aggressively than we do today, both from a salary perspective, which no one likes from politically, but which should happen, and from time, like trying to offer fellowships, maybe free college to go into public service, which is a really great idea that has never been pursued. Also, from a political perspective, in how we vote and how we do elections, there was some reference earlier to congestion pricing. You know, this is an initiative that the Mayor Bloomberg pushed and failed, right? And every year we talk about it, and it goes nowhere, and it just shows that there isn't, we don't treat these kinds of issues as politically important. We are making much more and more and it terrifies me, emotional decisions about how we vote based on what does the person I'm voting for believe and do I believe what they believe, then will they actually fix the problem? And that is a horrendous outcome for what we would hope, we would want and trust government to solve in terms of practical problems. Because these problems aren't attractive, they're not sexy, they're not covered by the media. They require serious people who are just going to get things done and be innovative to be in there to fix them.
Yeah. And I would add to that, the idea of failing fast does not mean being reckless. And as a taxpayer, I would like my city to not be reckless with their choices or my dollars. But I think it means recognizing in that startup mindset that failing fast actually just means learning smarter. And I think an area to go to a place that's not really sexy is procurement. And so many of our processes in the public sector are set up for things we know how to go out and measure, and we've bought them for years, and we've always bought them a particular way. And in the spirit of learning how to learn, I think cities, and I would encourage everyone to be thinking about how can you, whether it's a sandbox or a lower threshold for partnerships, do faster qualification on the ideas that we have and create enough of a buffer or a wall around the experiments that you can kill it in 2 months and it's no big deal. Because the other thing is with our procurement processes today, if you spend months and months and months vetting potential vendors, by the time you get around to implementing, you're kind of just done with it. You really don't want to go out to bid again. And so I think that's also in this idea of moving faster.
There was a question up here in the third row.
There's ways.
I was just thinking about the transition period. I mean, let's assume that you're in a city and you have the AV system and everything is mechanized or under control by software and Uber is available and you have 15% cars. But I'm a guy in the suburbs. I want to go to the opera and I'm coming in with my SUV. What am I gonna run into? And how do you get the public educated to move from individual gas powered vehicles to a system like you're all just saying is going to happen in between 5 and 20 years.
So I have a comment. One way we're doing it is we're to this idea of change, right? We're electrifying the Mustang and the F-150. So when you think about changing ideas about what innovative vehicles can be, I think that's a start.
I think the person who comes in from the subway will do what they do today. Exactly. It's not like we're going to take away all the parking that there is downtown. It's going to be exactly like it ever was for them. The second half of your question, which I thought I had an answer to.
How do we get people to migrate towards
change? Oh, I think it's going to be really economics driven. So very much as with Zipcar, when we started, everyone said people's egos are tied up in their cars, they're never going to do that. And what we proved is no, economics matters. Why am I paying $250 a month to park a car that I never use? So I think it'll be economics driven.
I would agree with that, and I would hope that that person exists, but there's far fewer of them, and the majority are taking some form of shared ride with other people to the Metro North station, which is beautiful and has a really sweet train on it. While they're on that train, they're connected to wireless, and they're coming in, and then they're getting right on the subway in a really nice subway car and going to the theater and then doing the same thing home, because it'll be much easier and cheaper than driving the SUV.
Thanks. There is a question in the aisle halfway to the back.
Hi, there are approximately 4 million professional drivers in the U.S. today. Just curious, how many of those you think are at risk? What are some of the alternatives for them for employment in the future, and who should be responsible for it?
So, as I mentioned earlier, from our perspective, the amount of demand that we've seen, both in existing areas and new areas, is so high. The number one thing that we care about is, frankly, getting more drivers on the road to deal with that demand. And I don't see any time in any, I mean, when I say near future, I mean 10, 20, long term, the way we look at it, where we're not going to have the need for those drivers. And a lot of our drivers are doing it outside of New York City for 10 or less hours a week. So it's a far lesser number in terms of personal commitment, but we see AV as complementing that existing service. And also in all of the AV cars we have right now, we actually, for a lot of different reasons, and this will continue for some time, we have drivers. We have two technicians to be there, one to monitor the mapping and the other to grab the wheel if, you know, something happens the computer can't handle.
Yeah, you just have to remember the turnover among professional drivers, taxi, TNC, or otherwise, long-distance truckers, is so high, you turn around and it's a completely new group. It is part of the overall change in the economy of jobs like that drying up. So there's kind of that larger issue, but it's not as if one would expect particular drivers to suddenly be out of work.
And I would add to that, I think there's two levels to it. One is the macro trends, which drivers are only a piece of the shift of the impact of technology. But I think it's important to recognize that with any technology, individuals are going to be impacted by this. And in those situations, I mean, we're in conversations, again, at the local level to understand what might people be retrained to do if their driver jobs go away. So, I mean, we're committed to trying to figure out that if anybody has ideas. I think it's also important to remember that with any technology, it's also creating other kinds of jobs. So you have people did not go to school to be autonomous vehicle programmers even but a few years ago. So I think, again, at the macro level, we're opportunistic about the jobs that it will create, but it's important to recognize individuals may need to have some reskilling.
I think it is going to happen faster than slower. And if I think about those, so one piece I would add to new jobs. So A, I think I care a lot about labor, loss of labor jobs. And I have a tax idea, which is that we might want to do a very small percentage tax on services that have drivers today and start creating a worker security fund, because I'm not at all convinced that the industry or the companies that deliver autonomous vehicles are going to be the same ones that are today. So we can't be, you can't make the people who lay off people, can't make the companies that lay off people pay some severance because they will be gone. Around jobs, this is not as nice as driving, but if we think about the percentage of trips that are driven in personal cars versus private cars, they will have more trips that are done in private cars, which means right now when I have my personal car, I maintain it for free, I wash it for free, and I refuel it for free. We're going to have a much larger number of shared vehicles in the world, and those cars will need to be washed, maintained, and fueled and unfueled. So that is a type of job that we'll see a lot more of. It's not the same as being by myself behind the wheel, for sure.
So we're going to need to wrap up our panel, but I wanted to ask Robin one last question before we go, and I don't know if there's an answer to this question. There's so many conversations happening right now in so many different ways, and some of them are so optimistic and futuristic in terms of kind of vehicles and all that they promise. Others are around TNCs and what to do about them in cities. You had referred to working with many different cities across the country to try and build an agenda around this. Is there a place where all these conversations are starting to come together, an agenda around developing what is it that we know, what don't we know, and what should we be doing so we can address the problems we have now? So as we move into this alternative future, we're set up for a successful integration of what's happening, where the market's going, what the technology can do, or is that something that still needs to sort of emerge?
I feel like a person who just wrote a book and you're letting me... So a place where these conversations are happening is, I put it on a website, it's called Osmosis, with a Y, OSMOSYS.org, and that's where these protocols and this conversation is starting to happen. In the next very short while, I've been talking to mayors around the world, and we're convening NGOs that are working on these topics around the world, and we're getting funding to address some of the data pieces. So it's coming together, but it's these early days. So that would be the location to find its current status.
I would like to thank